Well, just can I say that it's been good to be with you today as we share together. It's lovely. We've been able to have Ian over at Bank Hall, and the folks appreciated his ministry this morning, as I'm sure they will do this evening. And it's good that we can join together in fellowship, and we thank God for that, even if it's just done this in this way. Forgetting to put your teeth in may seem to be an unlikely occupational hazard. But for Ian MacDonald, it was a problem. Ian MacDonald is a farmer up in Scotland, 80 years old, and he's still going out every day looking after his croft near the Isle of Skye. This day he set out with his dog to go and look after his sheep, and he took everything that he needed, except he left his teeth at home. His problem was that when he got to where the sheep were, the dog would do nothing that it was supposed to do, because he couldn't whistle properly. And so his well-ordered plan for the day was smashed in pieces, because he had to then eventually give up, because the dog just went everywhere, and go back home, get his teeth, and start again. I say that as we come to Luke's Gospel. Now, why do I say that? I say it for this reason. That when we come to any Gospel and any book of the Bible, but as we come to this Gospel, it's not a disordered, jumbled up a series of stories about Jesus that Luke has decided to write down. Rather, it is full of purpose, it's full of plans, and if I can put it this way, Luke has his teeth in, and he's marshaled all of his material to ensure that everything works properly. And one of Luke's big ideas is to tell us about God's purpose and God's plan. And he wants to do that right the way through this gospel that he's written. We also know that he wrote the Acts of the Apostles. So Luke has probably written around about 20% of the New Testament. And we know that he does it in a very structured and ordered way, because if you look at chapter 1, then the opening verses tell us as much as that. Inasmuch, as he says, as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me, also having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. Now, there's all sorts of debates about who is Theophilus. It really doesn't matter in some ways. The important thing is that Luke set about the task of bringing this material, speaking to people and bringing things about so that he may write down the account, the orderly account of Christ and all that he is and all that he meant. And right throughout his book then, you will find that. But what I want us to do this evening is very briefly, is just looking at this opening chapter and to see how Luke employs his material as he gives us the narrative in contrasting two characters. Those two characters are Mary and Zechariah. Eamon read to us about the message that was given to Mary. But we're also going to look at the message that was given to Zechariah in the previous verses. And what Luke does then, he sets out God's great purposes and God's great plan. And what I want us to do this evening is just to go through the narrative and look at the comparisons and the contrasts between Zechariah and Mary, and then make some applications as we come to the end of our evening. So I hope that will be helpful to us. So first of all, we're going to look at Zechariah and Mary. The whole section has a number of pairs. Often Luke does that. And in chapter 1, we have Zechariah and Mary. But also in chapter 1, we have Elizabeth and Mary. In chapter 2, we have Mary and Joseph. And chapter 1, verse 5, right through to chapter 2, verse 52, we have John and Jesus. So often these pairs are being brought about for Luke to use the material to point up certain issues that are going to be helpful for his story. And for Zechariah and Mary then, what is it that we're hearing? We're hearing a message of God that is being announced. And it's the same message, isn't it? It's the message about a baby that's going to be born. If you look at chapter 1, then you'll see some of the things that become noticeable about these two characters as Luke merges or he compares them. For instance, in chapter 1, verse 7, we're told that Zechariah is an old man. In chapter 1, verse 27, we have Mary as a young woman. We know that then Zechariah, chapter 1, verse 5, is married to Elizabeth and is a descendant of Aaron. You compare Mary, who is going to be is betrothed to Joseph, and is of the house of David. Chapter 1, 26 and 27. We have their status. What are they within the community? Chapter 1, verse 5 tells us that Zechariah is a priest. And chapter 1, verses 26 and 27 tell us that Mary is a Galilean virgin. Where is the message given? The message is given, we're told, for Zechariah is at the altar in the temple, chapter 1, verses 8 to 11. And for Mary, it is in the village. The message is given, if you look at chapter 1, verse 13, for instance, but the angel said to him, "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son. You shall call his name John." And you look at chapter 1 and verse 31. "And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus." The response to those things are seen in verse 18 from Zechariah and verse 34 from Mary. Verse 20 of chapter 1, there is a sense of a judgment then upon the response. Similarly, in chapter 1, verse 35, that is also for Mary. Then chapter 1, verses 67 to 79, there is a celebration on the behalf of Zechariah. And in chapter 1, verses 46 to 55, there is celebration on the behalf of Mary. So you've got these two stories lined up one beside the other. It's not just because Luke thinks that that's good chronologically. I think Luke is doing that for very good purpose and very good reason. And I hope now we can just begin to see some of the lessons and some of the reasons as to why Luke is doing what he is doing. In both cases, as you follow the narrative, we have a remarkable birth, don't we? We know that that is a very strong theme right throughout the Bible. When we read about remarkable births, starts in the Old Testament with Isaac, and we've got also Samuel, and there are others. Out of darkness, out of gloom, and out of defeat, and out of despair, suddenly there's a birth of a child. And those births, or the promise of those births, are always indicated in the Old Testament of the intervention of God. God comes into the situation and he says to Abraham, "You're going to have a child. You're going to be the father of many nations." And as he gets older, that doesn't seem to be happening. And yet more and more, as he gets older, the promise is presented again. And then, of course, it happens. And there's the great intervention of God. Out of the seeming impossible, God brings hope and help. And the child that results from these storylines, from these births in the Old Testament, are then always people of significance. Always occasions that are telling us something about the moment, but also pointing to something in the future. And so when we've got the narrative here in the book of Luke, what is being pointed up is Luke is saying, now let's look back to the Old Testament. Let's look back at this wonderful, dramatic theme. Let's look back and see how God intervened in the past and brought forth children for his glory. Now let's see again what happened as we have it here. And so birth narratives were extremely important. They pointed up a way ahead. I listened to the radio some time ago, and Nikki Campbell, who is one of the Five Live presenters, I think he is an agnostic. Sometimes he is discussing with people about faith things. But I do remember that they were having a discussion on the radio between himself and his co-presenter at the time. And it was kind of a little bit off the cuff. And they got to talk about the birth of children. And he said quite an interesting comment. He said, I've never been closer to believing in God than when I held my children after their birth. And suddenly, and if you have been blessed with children and held them after they have been born, it is a remarkable moment. I used to think, I remember when my brother had his wife had his first child, and my parents were with us at the time, and they said, we have to go across and see this child. I'm scratching my head thinking, well, what's the big panic? Why do we have to go across and see this child? What's so important? And then a year or so later, I held my own firstborn, and I realized, yes, this is what it's all about, in the sense of, this is important. And so these births are significantly important, and the message associated with them. But let's look at the contrast, first of all, in Zechariah. Because we have a different response to the message that is being presented. Gabriel is the angel, as it were, who gives the message. And Zechariah, of course, he is struck dumb after asking his question, whereas Mary will be singing and making praise. Given the nature of the day and Zechariah's priestly ministry, he is given a greater assurance of God's presence and activity than maybe many of his contemporaries. Let's find out, where is Zechariah when all this takes place? Verse 8. Now, while he was serving as priest before God, when his division was on duty, according to custom of the priesthood, he was chosen by lot to enter the temple of the Lord and burn incense. So he's before the altar of incense. He's in the presence of the living God. We have a man who's going about the ministry of God in a place of interacting and communing with God. And I think within this, we have something of God's purpose. Zechariah was one of 18,000 priests. He would serve in the temple twice a year. Only once in his lifetime would he get to assist in the daily offering by going into the holy place. The honor would fall to him by way of lot. And we have then, him going in. As the lot is drawn, it's as if it's all by chance, but we see something of God's great purpose and God's great plan. Nationally, it's a moment of great significance for the priest to be in this position and mediating and interceding. Where better to meet an angel from the Lord than in the temple? It is the most sacred of sites. Within the day, who better to receive a message than a priest, a mediator between God and the people? One commentator says, Zechariah's problem is not that he lacks divine assurances, but rather that he does not believe the good news he is being given. Look at chapter 1, verses 19 and 20. I am Gabriel, who stands in the presence of God, and I was sent to speak to you and bring to you this good news. And behold, you will be silent, unable to speak until the day that these things take place, because you did not believe my words, which will be fulfilled in their time." It is the design of this narrative, even with its question, with its doubt, and even unbelief to a degree, that God will do what he promises, even though those circumstances would suggest a complete opposite. It's dark, it's gloomy, it's impossible, but God is going to act. And Zechariah, this man of God, because he was, this man who was a man of prayer, because he was, this man who was faithful, because he was, this man who is in the very presence of God and would be employed in the action of God as a priest, has a message of God. And it's as if he says, that's impossible. Now, contrastingly, Mary is minding her own business. She's betrothed to Joseph. As good as married, of course, but without any sexual relationship. She's in an anonymous village, far from the spiritual center. She's not looking for some kind of spiritual encounter. This is not the temple. This is not the altar of incense. This is just a village in the back of beyond. Look at verse 26. In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? Was the cry of the day. To a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. And the virgin's name was Mary. That's Luke's introduction to Mary. It's all very undistinguished, and within the normal environment of life. The narrative, though, is suffused with a sense of the grace of God, in both cases, but here. As God favors this woman, as God comes to this woman, and she was a faithful woman, and she was obviously a pious woman, she wasn't a perfect woman. She's just like you and me in that sense. But she was a woman favored by God who is going to be the recipient of something quite remarkable. And within this, God is supremely giving notice to the world of his intentions. You see, what's Luke's desire and aim? It's to bring about the purposes or show the purposes and plans of God. Where is it going to come from? It's going to come out of this seeming anonymous situation. God is going to be glorified and God is going to be seen. And so the angel comes to this humble location with some remarkable news. In terms of comparison, surely more remarkable than Zechariah's. For Zechariah, there's some kind of precedent for an action of God. I mean, if you go back to the Old Testament, Abraham and Sarah have Isaac when, of course, their age is spent and it's impossible, it would seem. A precedent is set. There's the possibility that it can happen. Even how remarkable it might be, it's happened before. In terms of Mary, no matter how many amazing births there have been in the Old Testament, there's never been a baby conceived without the intimate relations with another man, with a man rather. No male partner means no child. End of story. But even the nature of Mary's response is, how can this be since I don't know a man? The point is, her query, as one commentator says, her query is about the process, not the proof. I mean, how can it happen? I'm not doubting that You know, you want to do something amazing, but how can it happen? And Mary's response then speaks volumes. Look at verse 38. Behold, I am the servant of the Lord. Let it be according to your word. Isn't that just slightly different to Zechariah? You don't believe. Let it be according to your word. So Mary takes the word of the angel as a sufficient basis for faith. It's not going to be easy in the days ahead, either for her or for Joseph. But there's a sense of trust, a sense of acceptance about what God is doing, and she becomes an example of trust, one willing to be a vessel in the hands of God, and that God will demonstrate who he is. She then goes further, doesn't she, to express her position in a remarkable celebration that we have, and it's entitled possibly in your Bible, the Magnificat, verses 46 through to verse 55, the great song of Mary. The wonderful statement of faith and prophetical pronouncement. Zechariah, well, he can only communicate by hand signals and writing on his eye tablet. That's as far as he can go. And that's the priest. That's the man of God. So this humble woman is able to break into song. Verse 46, my soul magnifies the Lord and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior. What does she do in this song? She exalts God and his greatness. It describes Mary's lowly state, being lifted by God, verses 48 and 52. Good news for those such as who are in Israel, verses 50 to 52. Exiles will find hope for the future, as a reference to Abraham, verse 55. God will protect from the enemy. And replete right throughout this hymn, this song, are the great blessings of who God is. Old Testament language, declaring great truths. In short, Mary's Magnificat sets the agenda for God's gracious work in the rest of Luke's narrative and beyond, from generation to generation, verse 50. And you could compare, of course, this song to the song that Hannah sung way back in the book of Samuel, when she also had news of her remarkable birth, and that God would bring her a child, and that child would be used for God's glory. And years later, we have it being replicated in a more glorious and wonderful way. So what I think we've got here in these two storylines is the great contrast between Zechariah and Mary. Comparisons too, but Luke using his material to bring out God's great plan in all of these things. So what can we learn as we come to a conclusion this evening? I think there's about three or four things we can learn. We'll be done in just a few moments. I think the first thing that we can learn from this narrative and the way that Luke uses his material is that it is God who controls history and yet is full of surprises. God is working in the minutiae of life, controlling and ensuring that his plan of redemption is being outworked. We know who wins. God wins. Nothing is going to stop this plan or this purpose. For all of that, we are human and become anxious. We are human and we can be doubtful. We're human and we can despair. But we need to remind ourselves, and what Luke is doing, he's telling Theophilus, listen, this is the account of King Jesus. This is the account of the one that is in control of everything. And when you know who wins, it actually makes life a whole lot easier, doesn't it? I like football, and imagine for a moment that there's a big football game on. I'm not able to see it, but it's being recorded on the television, and but I'm able to hear the result. And the result is that my team wins. It's 3-0. We're down 3-0 to half-time, but we pull it back to 3-all and we win on penalties. I think I've heard about a game like that sometime. But we know who wins. Now I come home and I know the score and I can put on the television and I sit down to watch this match. Now I watch it in a completely different way while it's being rerun to how I would watch if it was live. If I was watching it when I was live, I would be thinking at halftime, I may as well just go for a walk. But now I know that we actually win. I'm not sitting on the edge of my seat. I'm not thinking, oh dear, what's going to happen next? I might still be shouting at the television saying, you've got to do this, you've got to do that, because that's what we do. But I can relax because I know who wins. I might think myself, did I get the scoreline right? But I know who wins. And I think Luke is presenting his material to tell us that in all of the ups and downs and all the Old Testament births were threatened, something could go wrong. And this birth is threatened too, the birth of Jesus, time and again. But God brings his purposes about because God is king, because God is in control. We need to remind ourselves that in a time of great gloom and darkness, God is constantly and consistently working and achieving everything to his glory. Remind yourself that when we get to the New Testament, there have been 400 years of silence between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The voice of God hasn't been heard. And now God speaks. He brings a message. Zechariah, you're going to have a baby son. Mary, you're going to bear a child without knowing sexual relationships. Zechariah, you'll call your son John. Mary, you'll call your son Jesus. And it's a time then of not hearing God's voice, and suddenly it comes. And we need to remind ourselves, particularly in the Western world, where sometimes we might think, well, it is dark and gloomy and difficult. But behind those scenes, God is actively working and achieving great things. We need to be aware of what Christ, the King of the Church, is doing. So first of all, God who controls history, yet is full of surprises. Here, would you have expected in this village or in this city, in this place called Nazareth, that these things would happen? Secondly, God's ways will be revealed and we must listen. There's a constant reminder throughout the gospel of Christ sharing a message. The disciples often fail to hear that message because they have a different perspective on the kingdom and its fulfillment, and they have to listen carefully. And it's only afterwards that they understand and suddenly they realize. Seems to me too that God reveals himself in his word to you and me today. We must listen that God is speaking, because God is speaking today, and it's through his word that he is speaking. I think the third lesson is that God is a God of mission. What all the Gospels do is tell us about God's action in reaching into his world. For Luke, that is something that plays in a particular way, as the gospel deals and hints at those who are going to come in. You go through the book of Luke and you'll find that it's the poor, it's the sick, it's the outcast, it's the impoverished, it's those on the edge, those on the outside that Christ is bringing in. He's come to seek and to save that which is lost. I suppose that is graphically displayed for us in the lost stories of Luke 15, when eventually you read about the two lost sons, don't you? It's the elder brother and the younger brother. Both of them are lost. And one comes in and one remains standing outside. And we have a God who's on a mission, who's bringing the unwholesome, it seems, in. Changing lives. Maybe your life this evening. He can change that and bring you in. The mission then is described. And then finally, just as we finish, in evangelism, I think this is a big kind of overall theme in the book of Luke. In evangelism, we need to learn to tell the story. Luke builds his material as he takes Theophilus and his readers on this journey. Every signpost is pointing towards the cross. The matrix signs on Luke's motorway is all pointing towards Jerusalem. Luke 9:51 is the kind of turning point in the book where we read that he sets his face towards Jerusalem. There's a little bit of a deviation on the journey, but that's, it's all about a journey. Jesus going up to Jerusalem. That God's purposes will be declared. And it seems to me we need to be those that we are sharing this wonderful story, developing the wonderful nature of who Christ is and God's great purposes for humanity, reaching into our lives, convicting of sin, bringing us to know the living God, being in a relationship with King Jesus. God working out his purposes. Isn't it wonderful to think this evening that he's still working those purposes out? That the material is brought here, not in some confusing way, not in some haphazard manner, but in a logical manner by which God is saying, I am doing and I am doing and nothing will stop. And may God help us to take heart today. One, that God, if we know and love the Lord Jesus Christ, is working in our lives and bringing his purposes about. And two, that he's always going to bring his purposes about within the community and within his world. And it's all going to be to the glory of his Son, King Jesus.